In one of his skirmishes, an untimely man, which as some of you may know, constitutes the longest subdivision of Twilight of the Idols, the small book that Nietzsche announced as his great declaration of war, the philosopher-psychologist, who by that time had started referring to himself as both the last disciple of Dionysus and the teacher of eternal return, directed his destructive hammer, because the subtitle of the book is Philosophizing with a Hammer, he directed his destructive hammer against something rather peculiar, against the coordinating conjunction and, as it was allegedly being employed in certain quarters of German philosophy. Quote, the Germans say Goethe and Schiller, Nietzsche proclaimed. I'm afraid they even say Schiller and Goethe. Don't people know it is Schiller yet? Unquote. Now, true to his epigrammatic style, Nietzsche didn't unfold a detailed argument, it's assertive rather than part of an argument, as to why he felt that the conjunction here offered yet another example of the psychological tactlessness of the Germans, but he nonetheless seemed to intimate here that it is distinctly inappropriate, if not to say altogether foolish, to believe that one author's ideas, be it Schiller or Goethe, may be better understood if they're juxtaposed, be it Goethe or Schiller, with those of one of his contemporaries or predecessors. In order to know, understand, and appreciate Schiller, Nietzsche seems to be saying, one doesn't need to know Goethe, and vice versa. Now, at first sight, this observation would appear to contradict Nietzsche's famous doctrine of the eternal recurrence, which has just been explained to you by my colleague and friend Sebastian Gardner, or at least a possible application of it. Goethe returning in Schiller, or Schiller returning in Goethe, not consecutively, but concurrently. Yet apart from the fact that the eternal recurrence, and I'm not sure Sebastian will agree with me, remained, at least in my humble opinion, a persistent question for Nietzsche, rather than a fully accomplished thought, or an abysmal thought in the mind of Zarathustra, I also think that the late Nietzsche, i.e. the Nietzsche before he collapsed in Turin, was very much preoccupied, and again you can disagree with me, with also redeeming the uniqueness of individual life, including, of course, his own. The redeeming of individual life against its absorption into the endless cyclical return of the same, against Zarathustra's burdensome vision of inescapable repetition, and against the amor fati. And this is what Nietzsche was saying here, that individual knowledge should never be deprived of its intrinsic capacity to break the constraints of fate, to liberate itself from doctrinal necessity, be it the doctrine of the eternal recurrence itself, so that it may acquire, I'm talking about knowledge, so that it may acquire the playful, the joyous, the humorous quality of the gay science. Maybe it's no coincidence that that Nietzsche, this is going to be full of slips, for various reasons, you know. But don't ask me about the reasons, right? So that knowledge may acquire the playful, joyous, humorous quality of the gay science. Maybe it's no coincidence that that is where the idea was mooted in some form of elaboration for the first time, as epitomized in the dancing lyrical poetry of the medieval troubadours. Now, tempting as it would have been, with all my due respect to Sebastian and so many others, tempting as it would have been to put my essay under the aegis of Freud and Nietzsche, or Nietzsche and Freud, although this in itself would have been but a repetition of a coordinating conjunction that has already been articulated and examined numerous times over, I've decided to embrace Nietzsche's critical stance here and avoid all attempts at rereading Freud through Nietzsche, including in the Lacanian sense of shedding light on his ideas or revealing the truth of his work by employing Nietzsche as an intellectual tool. Indeed, and again some of you will know this, this is how Lacan operated when he read Kant with Sade. Insofar as Sade, his libertine novels rather than the man himself, was being utilized by Lacan in order to disclose the cruel dialectical underside of Kant's categorical imperative in his system of pure practical reason, which, just as a little aside, is already a Nietzschean thought in its own right, because Nietzsche says somewhere about Kant's categorical imperative, es riecht nach Grausamkeit. It stinks of cruelty. The point of my contribution is not to show, therefore, once again, how Freud was indebted to Nietzsche, how Nietzsche had anticipated Freud, or how Freud and Nietzsche had arrived at the same conclusions. The point of my contribution today is to reflect upon what is potentially something much more intimate and fundamental than any coordinating conjunction may suggest. Rather than pursuing yet again the question of eternal recurrence through a specific coordinating conjunction linking Nietzsche to Freud, I want to address its significance and its resonances by focusing on another word. A word which is not a conjunction, but a preposition. And a preposition which signals belonging, ownership, and possession. More specifically, I'd like to explore with you the relationship between Freud and Nietzsche in terms of the preposition of, as in the Nietzsche of Freud, the Nietzsche who belonged to Freud, the Nietzsche Freud acquired, accepted, owned, and carried with him, both literally and metaphorically. In a literal sense, the Nietzsche who belonged to Freud, as I will show, hopefully, is simultaneously a mysterious absence and one of the most dominant presences in his work environment. And this spectral quality of Freud's Nietzsche returns, in a good Nietzschean sense, in the metaphorical dimension of belonging. Because for Freud, it is almost invariably associated with a strong judgment of negation, verneinung. A judgment which Freud himself aptly designated in his eponymous 1923 paper as a process whereby the repressed is intellectually accepted and rendered right of existence at the level of speech, but whereby the essence of repression itself, including its effective quantum, remains unacknowledged. In other words, what I will try to argue is that Freud didn't just possess Nietzsche, literally, as an object that stands out, as I will show, from all the others in his collection, owing to its simultaneous absence and presence, but that Freud was also possessed by him, as an intrusive revenant, whose exorcism would never be completed, and who would sometimes make his presence felt precisely in the absence of his very identity. Now, despite the voluminous literature on Freud and Nietzsche, relatively little is known about Freud's Nietzsche, i.e. about how Nietzsche was assimilated by Freud. Whether Freud ever read Nietzsche, and which, if any, of his books he cared to study in depth, remains a matter of ongoing speculation, and is quite likely never to be resolved. In a letter to Arnold Zweig of 11 May 1934, and some of you will know this quote, Freud wrote, quote, "In my youth, he, Nietzsche, was a remote and noble figure to me. A friend of mine, Dr. Parneth, had got to know him in the Engadine and had written a lot to me about him," unquote. Now, these days, the figure of Joseph Parneth is all but forgotten, although he is immortalized in the name of an antimicrobial intestinal cell, as a simple Wikipedia search will tell you. I admit my own failures. I googled it, and that's where I found it, because otherwise I would not have known. Thank God for Wikipedia. Yet during the early 1880s, Joseph Parneth and Freud studied together at the University of Vienna. And the two men became close friends. So much so that the prosperous Paleth at one point even set up a substantial endowment for his financially troubled brother, Sigmund Freud, whose interest Freud could use to subsidize regular trips to visit his fiancée in Wandsbek. We know this from the recently published letters to Martha. During the winter of 1883, Paleth met Nietzsche on various occasions in Nice and not in the Engadi, which is a region in Switzerland, as Freud recalled. Paleth met Nietzsche in Nice when Paleth was engaged in research at the zoological facility of Villefranche-sur-Mer, and Nietzsche spent his first summer on the French Riviera. This is a picture, you see there's a plaque there. You probably can't read it even when you sit at the front, but it says, "Ici, le 2 décembre 1883, Frédéric Nietzsche commença ses séjours à Nice." I don't think at the time the cat was there, or if there was a cat, it's unlikely to have been that one. And I'm not going to elaborate on the juxtaposition of the cat. But so Nietzsche in 1883-1884 spent time in Nice on the French Riviera and is now immortalized in this plaque on his house. Mysteriously, though, and this is the first major absence in Freud's Nietzsche, neither Joseph Paleth's letters to Freud, in which he reportedly wrote a lot about Nietzsche, nor Freud's responses to Paleth have ever been found. I did my best, but I failed. If you ever find them, tell me. Well, you can keep the finding to yourself, but I can guarantee you that you will have made your name in the history of psychoanalysis. In all likelihood, Freud destroyed Paleth's letters to him. Like, correct me if I'm wrong, Ivan, he destroyed all the letters that Flea sent to him. But we also don't know the letters that Freud sent to Paleth. No one's ever been able to find them. Paleth died prematurely from tuberculosis at the age of 32. But he would subsequently come to haunt Freud in one of his dreams. This is the famous non-vixit dream Freud analyzed in the 6th chapter of The Interpretation of Dreams. In this dream, Freud is sitting at a table with his Berlin otorhinolaryngologist, I didn't even think I was going to be able to pronounce that name, Wilhelm Fliess, and a deceased Joseph Paleth. When in the dream, Fliess suddenly asks Freud how much of his, Fliess's, affairs he's actually shared with Paleth. Freud responds with the Latin phrase, non vixit, which means, for those of you who know a bit of Latin, it means he did not live. Realizing in the dream that he's actually made a slip of the tongue, because he had wanted to say, non vivit, he's not alive. What follows, however, is perhaps even more telling than Freud's own onirical slip. Quote, this is in the dream. This is the manifest content of the dream. I then gave P a piercing look. Under my gaze, he turned pale. The German word is Bleich. His form grew indistinct and his eyes a sickly blue. And finally, he melted away. Unquote. Standard edition 5, page 421. You know, for those of you who want to look it up. Still as part of the dream content, Freud then realized that Paleth, quote, had been no more than an apparition, a revenant, unquote. Now, in the extraordinarily detailed analysis which follows this dream, almost as detailed as the dream of Irma's injection in its analysis, Freud unpacks almost each and every aspect of it, yet without ever identifying what stands out, at least to me, but maybe I'm prejudiced, the two Nietzschean themes that may have animated his unconscious dream thoughts as much as any of the other strands. Under Freud's piercing gaze, the spectral figure of Paleth, who had written to Freud at length about Nietzsche, at a time when Nietzsche had just published the first two parts of Thus Spoke Zarathustra and was working on the third part, Panit grows pale. The German term is Bleich. And is subsequently recognized as a revenant. Literally, someone who comes back or someone who has returned. Revenant is not a common word in German, by the way. It's a French word. Revenant. A revenant. Now, in the absence of Freud's correspondence with Panit, Euphonia, we do not know, and may never know, what, if anything, Panit wrote to him about the contents of Nietzsche's most recent work in 1883-1884. Yet one of the sections in the first part of Thus Spoke Zarathustra was devoted to the so-called pale criminal. In German, der Bleiche Verbrecher. See, it's the return of the word Bleich. Whereas the third part of Zarathustra finally formulates the abysmal thought of the eternal return. As a matter of fact, it's not just the paleness of Panit's face that conjures up Nietzsche's section on the pale criminal here, but it's also the juxtaposition of the pale and the eyes. In Freud's dream, Panit turned pale. His form grew indistinct and his eyes a sickly blue. In Nietzsche's Zarathustra, quote, the pale criminal has nodded. From his eyes speak a great contempt, unquote. So in Freud's dream, without Freud actually being able to acknowledge it, Joseph Panit, the great admirer of Nietzsche, returns from the dead before being killed off by Freud himself as a pale victim. Yet the Nietzschean resonances themselves remain repressed insofar as Freud does not succeed in any way in acknowledging the possibility of Panit here being a mere substitute for Nietzsche himself, who was of course still alive when Freud was analysing the dream, but of whom it could be said that for many years, non vixit, he had not lived. He hadn't lived for at least 11 years. For the record, I should also point out here that Nietzsche does appear twice in the interpretation of dreams, and once in On Dreams, which is the précis of the book that was published in 1901. Yet that in two of the three cases, when Freud refers to him, most notably when he talks about how the process of displacement verschiebung in dreams, i.e., this is the first quote, when the psychical intensity, the significance or affective potentiality of the thoughts is transformed into sensory vividness, unquote, and that it is similar to a transvaluation of psychical values, in two of the three cases, Nietzsche's name is not mentioned. It is in the standard edition, but it's added by Strachey. In the original German, it's not there. Would it be too far-fetched here to claim that Nietzsche's remarkable absence as a source and a reference in the interpretation of dreams, a book that can hardly be faulted for its scholarly qualities, when the topic under discussion concerns displacement on account of psychical intensity, would it be too far-fetched to claim that this was in itself very much a Freudian symptomatic recurrence of an unacknowledged displacement in his own non-vixit dream? The second major absence in Freud's Nietzsche can be derived from a passage in a letter Freud sent again to Wilhelm Fliess on the 1st of February 1900, a couple of months after the publication of The Interpretation of Dreams. Seemingly out of context, or at least without any clear direct reason, but we don't have Fliess's side of the correspondence, we only have Freud's side of the correspondence. Freud wrote to Fliess, quote, "I've just acquired Nietzsche, in whom I hope to find words for much that remains mute in me. But I haven't opened him yet, too lazy for the time being. unquote. Now, it's noteworthy here, linguists among you will recognize this, that the first sentence of this statement contains a new Verschiebung, a new displacement, or a metonymy, as Lacan would have it. When Freud conceded to Fliess that he had acquired Nietzsche after having quoted him without attribution in an interpretation of dreams, and as the one who had accurately defined the process of displacement in the dream work, this displacement here returned at the point where Nietzsche the man became the metonymical placeholder for Nietzsche the writer. Right? I have just acquired Nietzsche. It's a metonymy. What he means is I've just acquired Nietzsche's writings, if not all of them, at least some of them. Yet the statement is highly puzzling for a number of other reasons. And this story is full of mysteries that I will not be able to resolve. I'll be able to unravel them a bit, but I lay no claim to be able to resolve them. As they say in French, je vous en prie, après vous. Right? If before February 1900, Freud hadn't acquired Nietzsche yet, because otherwise why would you say that? Where exactly had he found the words by Nietzsche quoted in The Interpretation of Dreams? Both those unattributed and those attributed. That's the first question. Secondly, owing to the metonymy here, it's by no means clear which parts, which books, which writings by Nietzsche Freud had effectively acquired. In 1900, there was no such thing as a collected edition of Nietzsche's writings. So we need to assume that Freud could only have acquired individual volumes. What prompted Freud to do so? And in which of Nietzsche's published works would he have hoped to see his own muteness being transformed into words? We don't know. I really don't know. Thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, there isn't a single trace of any book by Nietzsche published before 1900 in Freud's personal library. Neither amongst the books he decided to bring with him to London, which you can look at down the road, nor in the archives and special collections of Columbia University. I actually went through the trouble of checking it, nor in the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. What happened to the Nietzsche that Freud acquired in his desperate search for words in 1900? Misplaced? Displaced? Lost? Destroyed? Lent? Sold? Deliberately discarded? Symptomatically forgotten? Freud's Nietzsche returns here in the missing volumes in his own library. And in the absence of Freud's own personal copies, it is of course impossible to establish whether he eventually managed to overcome his laziness and had actually succeeded in opening his Nietzsche. Much like the silence, ladies and gentlemen, that reigned over Freud during the early months of the 20th century, Freud's Nietzsche remains a mute record. Speechless. Speechless in its mysterious disappearance. A ghostly presence amongst Freud's acquisitions, of which we wouldn't have known anything were it not for his letter to Fliess, and which in itself repeats the displacement of the Verschiebung that Freud himself had displaced earlier onto a nameless Nietzsche in the non-fixed dream of The Interpretation of Dreams. It's getting better. Sorry, this is not a judgment of the quality of my own paper. I mean the suspense. I mean the mystery is getting better. During the spring of 1908, the Vienna Scientific Society, which tended to gather on Wednesdays at Freud's home in Berggasse 19, during the spring of 1908, the Society discussed the third essay, which was referenced by Sebastian, on the meaning of ascetic ideals of Nietzsche's 1887 book on the genealogy of morals. The topic had been suggested not by Freud himself, but by a member of the Society called Eduard Hitschmann, who was a medically trained psychoanalyst, who'd also been in analysis with with Freud for a couple of months, and who had even briefly acted as Freud's family doctor. Totally irrelevant, but anyway. During the exchange of views following Hitchman's presentation of Nietzsche's work, some of the participants at the meeting, including Alfred Adler and Paul Faden, were very keen to point out how Nietzsche had anticipated key psychoanalytic insights. Yet Freud himself responded to the text with a statement that would become the stuff of legend. Otto Rank, who acted as the secretary of the meetings, minuted Freud as follows. I will read it out in German first. This is Otto Rank's handwriting, which, unlike Freud's, is just about legible. So this is the original manuscript of the minutes of the Vienna Psychoanalytic Society of the spring of 1908. And the quote starts... I thought there was a pointer here. The quote starts there, okay? So for those of you who can read German and who sit in the front, you might be able to follow. So Rank minutes Freud as follows. Auch Nietzsche kenne... He means Freud. Auch Nietzsche kenne nicht. Ein gelegentlicher Versuch, ihn zu lesen, sei an einem Übermaß von Interesse erstickt. Trotz der von vielen Seiten hervorgehobenen Ähnlichkeiten könne er versichern, dass Nietzsches Gedanken auf seine eigenen Arbeiten gar keinen Einfluss gehabt hätten. Unquote. Now, the official English translation of these sentences in the minutes of the Vienna Psychoanalytic Society, the official English translation reads as follows. He, Freud, doesn't know Nietzsche's work. Occasional attempts at reading it were smothered by an excess of interest. In spite of the similarities which many people have pointed out, he, Freud, can give the assurance that Nietzsche's ideas have had no influence on his own work. Unquote. Now, if we take these sentences as an accurate transcription of Freud's intervention on that day, and in all likelihood Freud would have read them because he was close enough to Rank to read over the minutes before approving them, if we take these sentences as an accurate transcription, then a number of new questions emerge. Questions which again revolve around a series of displacements and negations. One, although Freud had been regularly informed of Nietzsche's ideas by Joseph Parnett during the early 1880s, in 1908 Freud claimed he did not know him. Two, although he claimed he didn't know him, he admitted that he had occasionally tried to read him. Three, although he didn't know him, despite Parnett's letters and the occasional attempts at reading him, Freud did know that his thoughts had had no influence on him. Now, whereas it might make sense to argue that direct influence could only have occurred on the basis of some in-depth knowledge and understanding, for late 19th century Viennese intellectuals, Nietzsche was more than a book. To adopt the phrase that W.H. Auden used after Freud's death, for the Viennese, Nietzsche constituted, quote-unquote, a whole climate of opinion, in which Freud would have been immersed during much of his formative years, and even later on. Noting the date on which this meeting of the Vienna Society had been held, I should have photographed the slide, but I didn't, and you can't see it from this one here, you know, because it's another page of the manuscript. But noting the date on which the meeting had been held, i.e. the 1st of April, Todd Dufresne has observed, quote, if these remarks about Freud claiming that he didn't know Nietzsche seems disingenuous, it is at least fitting that they were made on April Fool's Day. Now, light-hearted, as the comment may be, it does actually point, and that will be, this sounds terribly self-congratulatory, the culmination of my paper. Light-hearted as the comment may be, it does actually point towards an often neglected part of Freud's character and of his works. Notably, his humour, his irony, his general playfulness. But let us assume for a moment that Freud was brutally honest when he conceded, in 1908 on April Fool's Day, that all his attempts at reading Nietzsche, the Nietzsche he had acquired during the early months of 1900 and which had mysteriously disappeared in the creases of his own personal library, had indeed been smothered, or more literally, suffocated, because the German word erstickt is to suffocate. Then the reason Freud gave, then the reason Freud gave for these aborted attempts is highly peculiar. Whereas one might decide to stop reading a book, I'm talking for myself here, but I'm sure you'll recognize it, because it's terribly boring, or because it fails to sustain your attention, i.e. you decide to stop reading a book because of an absence of interest, Freud claimed that what has made his reading of Nietzsche impossible was exactly the opposite. But of course the German phrase, ein Übermaß von Interesse, is also profoundly ambiguous. The official English translation renders it as an excess of interest, which is entirely correct. But it leaves the question open as to whose interests Freud had actually in mind here. It might seem self-evident that Freud intended to refer to how his own excessive interest had prevented him from reading Nietzsche, but it is equally plausible for the expression to signal Nietzsche's excessive interest in and to or for psychoanalysis. With the proviso that, for obvious reasons, because he'd already collapsed in Turin, Nietzsche could never have read any of Freud's psychoanalytic writings. Just as a little aside, in 30 seconds, Nietzsche had a copy of Freud's translation of John Stuart Mill. So he could have come across the name of Freud in a roundabout way. There's no way he could have read anything by Freud. Either way, what would have been the most persuasive argument in support of Freud's ignorance of Nietzsche is once again displaced here. The argument is displaced onto its radical and its paradoxical opposite. What stops Freud from reading Nietzsche is an overwhelming presence, an irreducible surplus. It is as if Freud, in his quest for words, had found too many, or had been overwhelmed by an abundance of ideas whose psychical intensity and affective potentiality had forced him to have recourse again to a symptomatic displacement measure. Once again, Freud's Nietzsche returns. He returns as a ghostly apparition, an excessive absence, a haunting presence, like the figure of Joseph Parnell in the Non-Vixen Dream. Now, I shall refrain, for reasons of time, from commenting on Freud's Nietzsche in his books and papers from the 19-teens and early 1920s. I think Antonius will talk a little bit about how Nietzsche reappears, although nameless, in Beyond the Pleasure Principle. And also detailed elaborations of the Nietzschean Freud during this period can be found in two excellent books, one by Paul-Laurent Ossoune, with a very un-Nietzschean title. It's called Freud and Nietzsche. And another, even better book, which sadly will set you back, I think, 300 euros, by Reinhard Gasser, which you may know, which comes in just at under 800 pages. It's just about the best book on that's ever been written, 1997. Unfortunately, again, it has a very un-Nietzschean title. It's called Nietzsche und Freud. And yes, it is in German. So you know, I shall refrain from going into this because you can read it in those two books and in the numerous other papers. With the exception, ladies and gentlemen, of a passage from Freud's 1925 autobiographical study. In the 1925 autobiographical study, Freud reflected briefly on his critical engagement with philosophical thought. After admitting that the theory of psychoanalysis finds an echo in the works of Schopenhauer, despite Freud's alleged unfamiliarity with his teaching and his having read Schopenhauer only late in life, that's Freud admitting it, Freud says of Nietzsche, quote, "Here is another philosopher whose guesses and intuitions often agree in the most astonishing way with the laborious findings of psychoanalysis. and who was for a long time avoided by me on that very account. I was less concerned with the question of priority than with keeping my mind unembarrassed." Unquote. Now, should we interpret this statement as indicative of the fact that Freud had at one point succeeded in overcoming the obstacle of the excess of interest? Should we interpret this as indicative of the fact that Freud had finally opened his Nietzsche, thus accepting to embarrass his mind with Nietzsche's guesses and intuitions? If this is, and shall no doubt again forever remain, a rhetorical question, then the other question, the question of priority, provides another instance here of Freudian verneinung. Because according to Richard Sterber, in his own memoirs, and he had been a member of the Vienna Scientific Society in the same year that Freud composed the autobiographical study, according to Richard Sterber, Freud once confided in him, quote, this is Freud talking to Sterber, "He who wants to be original should not read Nietzsche." Freud can hardly be excused here for not knowing all that much about the mechanism of negation. We really can't use that as an excuse. And thus, of negating negation. Because his own essay on negation had been published 2 years before the autobiographical study. Right? So you can reasonably assume that he knew something about negation. If Freud's Nietzsche from 1900 has mysteriously disappeared, without even leaving as much as a file card symbolizing its absence here in London at Columbia and in the Library of Congress, then Nietzsche made a surprising, spectacular, and massive reappearance in 1926 on the occasion of Freud's 70th birthday. In May 1926, Nietzsche returned to Freud in a totally unexpected and wholly excessive fashion. Now again, the exact circumstances, and I had a discussion with Elizabeth Houdinesco about this earlier this week, but we didn't get very far, the exact circumstances of Nietzsche's return to Freud are again couched in mystery, insofar as it remains unclear how and when Nietzsche arrived. None of Freud's biographers, including Peter Gay, have been able to answer this question. However, since the day of Nietzsche's reappearance, and unlike his previous incarnations, Nietzsche has not left Freud's side anymore, and has become a constant, visible presence in his work environment. For his 70th birthday, on the 6th of May 1926, Otto Rank, this is Otto Rank, sent Freud a most extraordinary present, the Musarion edition of the complete works of Nietzsche, of which only 1,600 copies were ever printed. However, what made Rank's gift extra special is that it concerned one of only 185 copies of a collector's edition of the set, printed on cotton paper, which means it doesn't deteriorate over the years, and bound in the finest white leather. Here it is. This is not Freud's copy. I'll show you Freud's copy in a minute. This is a copy that you can still buy online for, I think, about $16,000. Because it's a collector's edition. Freud's copy, by the way, carries the number 166. Now, as I pointed out, the exact circumstances of this gift have thus far not been reconstructed, owing to a strange absence of details in Freud's contemporary correspondence with Rank and with others. I need about 5 to 10 minutes. Okay. It remains unknown how and from whom Rank, who was living in Paris at the time, purchased the books, and it's equally unclear when and how they were delivered to the Burgasse 19. On the 23rd of May, Rank wrote a letter to Freud, and this would be the final letter of correspondence between the two men. Rank wrote a letter to Freud which he opened with the words... they're actually already there. I was very glad that our birthday present pleased you. I also heard from my wife, Mrs. Bialagang, how fine and festive everything was. He means the birthday celebrations. Now, on the day itself, a handful of Freud's closest collaborators gathered in Freud's drawing room to celebrate the occasion. In his biography of Freud, Jones mentions that the presence of the members of the committee and some other members of the society, but at that time Rank had already moved to Paris, and Jones did not recall the presence of Rank's wife in the Berggasse either. Well, on the 18th of May, Anna Freud wrote to Lou Andreas Salomé. We now have the two volumes of the complete correspondence between Anna Freud and Lou Andreas Salomé, who had obviously known Nietzsche intimately, right? If not to say horizontally. that's another point of discussion. Anna Freud said that some 200 people had come to visit Freud in the space of 2 days, but she didn't mention any names, and she didn't single out any of the gifts Freud had received. Jones, in his biography, did list various gifts that were presented to Freud on the day, but he didn't make any mention of Rank's presence. However, on the 23rd of September 1926, Jones felt the need to write to Freud from London, seemingly in response to a remark Freud himself had made previously, although not in writing. Because the remark that Freud made is not in any of the correspondence with Jones. So maybe they spoke over the phone, I don't know. This is what Jones says. The Laforgues, this is René Laforgue and his wife from Paris, are in London this week. He, Laforgue, told me that Rank told him in June of this year that he was on most amicable terms with you, in proof of which he cited the fact that he had recently given you a present that cost $300. I checked it, $300 in 1926 is roughly the equivalent of about $4,000 now. So we've been a huge amount of money. Your interpretation of the Nietzsche Symptomhandlung was thus confirmed, unquote. I have no idea where Freud mentions Symptomhandlung. I mean, maybe it was in private at the birthday party, but definitely not in the correspondence with Nietzsche, with Jones. However, Freud's response to Jones's letter confirms his attitude towards his newly acquired Nietzsche. The passage here deserves to be quoted in full, because it's the only written trace we have of Freud's reaction. Quote, "You, Jones," he says, "you too may have been puzzled by the lack of logics in Rank's statement that he's on the best of terms with me, adducing as a proof that he made me a costly present. I'll be quick because of time. The conclusion would have been justified if I had given the present to him. As it was, the gift sprang from a mixture of different motives. The oppressing feeling of owing so much to me, even in money, a reaction of gratitude, or rather against gratitude, a tendency to boast of his newly acquired riches, and a self-destructive impulse to spend all his earning, which appears also in other doings of his. I'm not at all sure what the final result of his career may be. He doesn't belong to those easygoing scoundrels to whom success in life is assured." Unquote. You see, that's what happened if you fell out with Freud. Rank fell out with Freud a couple of months earlier, and, these are the response that he got. Now, over the years, and I don't have time to elaborate on this, over the years, many historians of psychoanalysis have produced their own interpretation of Rank's gift. And I was tempted at some point to do a Derridean reading of the practice of gift-giving, but I don't have time for this. Many of them have highlighted the fact that Rank, who had been, of course, deeply immersed in Nietzsche's works for a long time, and who would go on to develop the first, what I think is explicitly Nietzschean psychoanalytic approach, which revolves around the will, the notion of the will therapy, Rank calls it. Rank had probably also wanted to remind Freud here how much he'd been indebted to the philosopher's ideas, despite his own recurring denials. I just need a couple of minutes, I apologize. Now, Poison Chalice, as Freud's 1926 Nietzsche may have been, when in June 1938 the time came to pack his belongings and to go into exile in London, Nietzsche travelled with him. And Nietzsche became one of the most conspicuous, if not the single most striking part of Freud's library in London. If only, there it is, by the way. If only because the 23 volumes occupy a central space in the main bookcase, and their white color makes them stand out from all the other books in that section. Did Freud ever open his new Nietzsche? Did he browse through it, reading the books he hadn't read before, rereading parts with which he'd already familiarized himself? We don't know. Freud here may have finally accepted the return of the repressed in his own symptomatic engagement with the philosopher's guesses and intuitions, an acceptance which allowed Nietzsche to fully acquire the status of an indomitable pale, literally, a pale revenant, who would continue to look over his shoulder, because Freud was sitting here, who would continue to look over his shoulder during the last year of his life, it's getting better, as he had done for the last years in the Berggasse. These are the pictures that Edmund Engelmann took just before the Nazis ransacked Freud's house. It's the only record, photographic record we have of what Freud's study looked like in the Berggasse. So what do you see? Freud was sitting here. What's there? The pale revenant of Nietzsche. Now, at this point, I want to end, Ivan will be pleased to hear this, I want to end my brief and largely speculative account of Freud's Nietzsche with some remarks on another, perhaps less symptomatic gift. A gift which was hardly received, to the best of my knowledge, any attention at all. Far less conspicuous than Rank's collector's edition of the Musarium-Ausgabe, right? And I don't think I'm exaggerating. Much smaller in size and much more difficult to locate in Freud's library, there is an unknown essay by Freud on Nietzsche. Did you notice? There is an unknown essay by Freud on Nietzsche, published in 1932, in a collection entitled Unter falscher Flagge, eine Lesebuch der deutschen Sprache für Fortgeschrittene. The two-page text is entitled Nietzsche's Verdauungsbeschwerden als Symbol einer präembryonalen Tantenliebe. In English, Nietzsche's digestive problems as a symbol of his pre-embryonic love for his aunt. Now, if the title sounds hilarious, I guarantee you that the content of the paper is even more farcical than the title suggests. Now, before you get too excited, and I can feel the excitement in the room, or perhaps bitterly disappointed, that someone as serious as Sigmund Freud would have indulged in this foul, as Nietzsche would have it, this stinking type of applied psychoanalysis, I should point out straight away that the paper in question was, of course, not written by Freud himself. It's a jovial satire. It's a jovial satire of psychoanalysis produced by the Austrian writer Robert Neumann, who gained a reputation during the 1920s for elevating the genre of parody to a literary art form. In November 1932, Neumann sent Freud a gift. He sent him a gift. An inscribed copy of his book, Unter falscher Flagge. Undoubtedly convinced that the founder of psychoanalysis would appreciate seeing his ideas being employed for the purposes of literary humor. Again, we don't know whether Freud acknowledged receipt of the book and how he reacted to the spoof. Yet maybe it's no coincidence that of all the figures in the history of philosophy, Neumann chose as the object of Freud's fictional psychobiography here the last disciple of Dionysus, the teacher of the eternal return, whose digestive symptoms were singled out for a small tranche of applied Freudian psychoanalysis. Now here, of course, this is the last paragraph. Here, of course, we have another instance, and perhaps the supreme example, of Freud's Nietzsche, although it only runs to two pages. An unambiguous illustration of how Freud had recuperated Nietzsche as a gift, beyond the grave, as a spectral patient whose symptoms could be explained with the tools of psychoanalysis, or at least his digestive problems. Nietzsche returned to Freud here, not as a philosopher whose works were unapproachable on account of ein Übermaß von Interesse, but as a human, all too human, comical figure. A figure whose persistent digestive ailments provided psychoanalysis with fertile soil for playful interpretation. And whereas one could easily dismiss Neumann's parody as a misplaced attack on psychoanalysis, I think this Nietzsche may come closer to the Nietzschean inspiration of psychoanalysis than anyone has ever identified. Why? Because it also captures Freud's theory as a possible gay science, as a theory that is saturated with humour in the seriousness of its doctrinal aspirations, as a theory that is permeated with playfulness in its very attempts at mastering the secrets of the human soul. Throughout his life, this is my conclusion, Freud acted towards Nietzsche, I think, like the child who tried to come to terms with the traumatic absence of his progenitor by repetitively engaging in the game of Forte Da. Absence and presence, right? So Freud's Nietzsche is like the child playing with the real, absence and presence. Yet over and above the mechanism of the repetition compulsion that Freud recognized in the Forte Da game, one mustn't forget, and it's often forgotten, that the activity of Forte Da is staged as a game and is therefore also endowed with the affective qualities of joy, of fun, of laughter. So tragic and symptomatic as many scholars have designated Freud's negation of Nietzsche's influence on his work, I think one shouldn't ignore the fact that Freud played with Nietzsche. And that if Freud's Nietzsche, even on April Fool's Day, 1908, according to Todd Dufresne, and that if Freud's Nietzsche was a persisting, haunting presence, a persisting, haunting presence, looking over his shoulder, much like Nietzsche's own notion of the eternal recurrence, was set against the background of an ongoing critique of stale dogmatic thinking, this is maybe the Nietzsche we need to recognize in Freud. If Nietzsche hadn't collapsed in Turin, he himself may have recognized in Freud an anti-philosophical ally in the psychoanalyst's profound wariness of Weltanschauung. Fate, ladies and gentlemen, decides otherwise. But just because fate decided otherwise, it shouldn't stop us from thinking that psychoanalysis and Freud's Nietzsche may be the ultimate epitome of a gay science. Thank you very much.